Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Legatum Institute, which, for those of you who remain unenlightened on this question, is part of the Legatum Group, which is domiciled and headquartered in Dubai, and is an international organisation with its financial funds established in Dubai, and also with a very wide range of organisations affiliated to it, such as, for example, the Freedom Fund, recently established, which takes the fight against slavery in its modern form, human trafficking, to a global effect, and also, of course, the work of the Legatum Institute itself, which is, in a way, a think tank, but a think tank with an international range of interests and a concern for the interdisciplinary way in which different disciplines come together in order to support the causes of individual human freedom, prosperity, and liberty. Now, in the last 4 years since Legatum Institute really got going, we have established something of a reputation through the annual publication of our Prosperity Index for breadth of interests and depth of understanding, width of culture, and depth of scholarship. Nonetheless, hardly any of us can hold a candle to our very distinguished guest this evening, so far as breadth and width is concerned. Rowan Williams, known to the public world as Lord Williams of Oystermouth, of course, but to all his friends and acquaintances for some decades as just Rowan, has been an adornment of Ecclesia Anglicana for some years. He would have adorned the Church of England at any time, indeed, in its illustrious history since the 6th century. But he did, of course, have his starter archbishopric before he was translated to Lambeth. And Ecclesia Walia, as we all know, is even older than Ecclesia Anglicana. So having got his starter archbishopric out of the way, he was then raised to great eminence. But the true eminence that is Rowan's is not a question of the hierarchical dignities of church and state. It's really a question of scholarship and learning, and his ability, with the natural and unadorned eloquence of the Welshman, to communicate these things to a wide and delighted audience. He made his reputation as a young man to magisterial effect, really, astonishingly so, with a range of his publications on the history of the early church. But his has never been an intelligence that is content with just mastering one discipline or even just one recondite language. He spans the disciplines and he leaps from one vertiginous cultural height to another with the agility and the finesse of a Welsh mountain goat. And this really is why I was so very delighted when Rowan said a few months ago that he'd be very happy to come along and give this final talk in the series of lectures that we've been holding here at the Legatum Institute during these winter months on the world in 1913-14, the cultural world of 1913-14. These are the issues that we were looking at through the prism of individual biographies. We started with Vernon Bogdanow talking about Sir Edward Grey, the Foreign Secretary, in that fateful last year of peace. And we went on to talk about Coco Chanel, the great entrepreneur, and entrepreneurialism is something that we're rather keen on in this institute. We even have an institute, a foundation, at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The Legatum Fund has endowed in order to study the means by which entrepreneurs change the world. Well, Coco Chanel certainly changed the world, and in the course of addressing us on that evening, Justine Picardy, the distinguished biographer of Coco, managed to convince us of Coco's enduring place in the pantheon of values. And so to the rather different kind of character that we're going to be talking about and that Rowan is going to be talking to us about this evening. Von Harnack was by any standards, one of the very greatest scholars produced by a culture, a country, always notable for its zeal and respect for scholarship and originality of thought. But he grew to greatness at a time in German history when its culture was becoming very unstable, when its politics was becoming even more unstable than that of the rest of contemporary Europe. Von Harnack occupies an unique place in the history of Christian scholarship, and he also occupies a very important place in the history of German culture in these last years of peace. But as Rowan will go on to tell us, he carried on living for a rather long time after that and carried on being very important to Germany and to Europe. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's with very great pleasure that I introduce to the Legatum Institute, Rowan Williams.
Thank you very much indeed, Howell, and thank you for the opportunity to explore this remarkable personality a little with you this evening. On August the 4th, 1914, the day on which war was declared between England and Germany, Kaiser Wilhelm II assembled the members of the Reichstag for an extraordinary meeting. He spoke briefly, but very eloquently on that occasion, essentially about Germany's moral case for going to war. He speaks about the self-defense of Germany. He speaks about the need to defend the place in which God has put us, a phrase which resonates, I think, in many ways, the understanding of what was going on at that time. Den Platz zu bewahren, auf den Gott uns gestellt hat. He speaks of the need to resist the unersättliche Nationalismus of Russia, the insatiable nationalism of Russia, and claims that his government has never had anything in mind as a goal except to develop the ethical, spiritual, and economic strength of its people. A moral case for the war. A moral case which does not seem to have come absolutely naturally to the lips of the Kaiser. We know from other sources just what a level of mental confusion he was experiencing at the time, and emotional confusion. But this speech, and the speech which he'd given a little while before from the balcony of the Royal Palace in Berlin, both set out Germany's God-given role in Europe, the need to defend it against the barbarism, especially of the Slavs, and to a lesser extent the barbarism of the French, but that's another story. And it presupposes a particular kind of ethical and religious mindset, which is what I want to try to explore a little with you this evening. The speech from the throne in the Reichstag was drafted in part by Karl Gustav Adolf von Harnack, at that time the director of the Royal Library in Berlin, one of the founders of the Kaiser Wilhelm Gesellschaft, the most important academic and cultural association, a man whose distinction as a church historian and New Testament scholar and philologist was unparalleled not only in Germany, but in the whole of Europe. Harnack, recently ennobled, stood for the supreme achievement of German culture, it might be said. And it wasn't entirely surprising that he should be drafted in to help the Kaiser and the nation at this particular point. In September 1914, Harnack and some of his theological colleagues issued an appeal to Protestant Christians in Europe, once again underlining the need for peace, the need to avoid misrepresenting Germany, the need for Germany to defend its historic and God-given role. And most famously or notoriously of all, in the following month, on October the 23rd, Harnack was one of 93 signatories to an open letter to the cultivated world of Europe, the so-called Manifesto Intellectuellen, the Intellectuals' Manifesto, which attempted to counter reports of German atrocities in Belgium, and which once again insisted on Germany's right to self-defense, Germany's God-given vocation to defend Europe against Asiatic barbarism. There's quite a lot about turning the other cheek. It is crystal clear that this is a private matter. This is how you behave in your family, he says. This is how you behave among your friends and your colleagues. Non-resistance, unselfishness, the yielding up of your own position is something you must develop as an individual. Because Jesus always and only addresses the individual in one of his most resonant phrases. Jesus always and only addresses the individual. And Harnack suggests that Jesus is so confident in the triumph of law and justice that he never feels the need to consider that justice will need force to back it up. Jesus is so much of a political idealist, you may say, that he never raises the question of whether the commands of government need to be enforced and what our attitude ought to be to that force. A violent state, and Harnack is clear about this, a violent state is an offence against justice. But legitimate force, the requirement of obedience to the law in all its aspects, the requirement, therefore, also, in the words of the 39 Articles, to bear arms at the commandment of the magistrate, all this must be part of what Jesus would have taken for granted had he thought about it. Behind it is what Harnack states with passion rather more than clarity at one important point in the argument. There is a complete opposition between the world of spirit and flesh, between the world of ethics and the world of physics, as he puts it. And whether you call it ethics versus physics, or God versus the world, or spirit versus flesh, the same thing is going on. We live in the heart of an irresoluble tension between the demands of the society we live in, with its resort to force, and the demand for inner transformation. We cannot dissolve that tension coming down simply on one side or the other. We cannot be totally uncritical about the state, but neither do we have any right to say that there is a Christian duty to resist. Only one thing matters. Only one relationship matters. Only one imperative matters, he says, and that is to be God's child, to be a citizen of the kingdom, to live in love. His passage on the tension, the dualism that he sees in human life is, as I've hinted, one of the least lucid passages in what is generally a beautifully lucid exposition. It's a point at which, had he not been so allergic to philosophical speculation, he might perhaps have found a few helpful allies in the intellectual history of the 19th century. But that, again, is another story. Suffice it to say that he did not like Hegel. But this allows him to Days of party conflict are over. I now put myself before you, not as a representative of any party or interest in the state, but as the representative of this state and this nation. And for the duration of the conflict, we must forget about partisan identity. That patriarchal, organic view of society is something which clearly had a strong draw for Harnack. And again, it has its roots in precisely that North German Lutheran tradition out of which he came. A tradition which is entirely serious about the imperatives of both the gospel and the law, and refuses to offer any premature resolution or reconciliation between them. Unsurprisingly, Harnack quotes Goethe. At some point, you know that he is going to quote Goethe, just like every good German intellectual. And the passage he chooses to quote from Goethe is essentially about tensions that can only be lived through and overcome by the living of them. You don't rush to the end, you don't find a formula, a speculative philosophical scheme which can hold this together. You patiently live through the potentially difficult work of being a good citizen in the patriarchal organic state and allowing yourself to be transformed internally. It's in that sense that it's actually quite hard to recognize Harnack as a democrat, precisely. And there is, I think, more to be said and more to be explored about exactly what his relationship was to ideas of democracy. But it seems to me an underrated element in his overall position, this patriarchal sense of a society in which political party conflict, what you might call the life of the agora or the forum, is really not of very great interest, either to the ruler or to the believer. Another area worth exploring, but I mention it only to pass on hastily, is Harnack's relation to Tolstoy. Because, of course, at the time he was writing these lectures, Tolstoy's work was widely discussed in religious and cultural circles across Europe. And at several points in the lectures, Harnack feels the need to turn sideways, as it were, to address Tolstoy and say, "I quite see why you say what you do, but that can't be it." Tolstoy wants a visible, a manifest detachment of the believer and the believing community from the state, its power, and its violence. Harnack says to Tolstoy, as it were, "You're absolutely right to see two completely different orders in conflict here. But the conflict is precisely not the conflict between two sorts of institution or two sorts of community. It's a conflict within the human will and can only be resolved in the individual's life." So I hope that some of that gives a little background to why and how, in August 1914, Harnack found himself drafting speeches for the Kaiser of the kind that he did draft and supporting the Manifesto of the Intellectuals. He is not, let's be clear, an uncritical German nationalist. The point is not that there is something mystically superior about being German, though there are one or two passages where he says a little near the wind on that. It is more that here is a legitimate state, a Rechtsstaat, which history has endowed with very particular intellectual and spiritual gifts, which has a particular vocation within Europe, a God-given role within Europe, and which has an obligation, therefore, to defend its cultural heritage and to resist all those non-European forces which seek to undermine it. I'll come back in a moment to some of the slightly more ambivalent elements in that. But I think it's important to take seriously the fact that Harnack is not a forerunner of the Third Reich in any intelligible sense whatever. What then has he got to say about actual Christian churches and actual Christian practice. The last cluster of lectures in the series deal in sequence with varieties of Christianity through the ages and at the present day. And once again, we learn a great deal about what Harnack thought of faith in society from looking at what he says about specific churches and their practices. Catholicism is clearly a major problem, as it was a major political problem in the Germany of his day, and the Germany of his earlier years even more so. But he's a fair-minded man, and he grants that one of the great things that Catholicism has done is to resist what he calls Staatsomnipotenz, the all-powerfulness of the state. Catholicism at least says there is some area of human life which the state does not control. The mistake, as with Tolstoy, is to say that the division between what the state does and doesn't control can, so to speak, be externally marked. The Catholic Church ought to be saying that what the state doesn't control is the inner life, the conscience. What the Catholic Church ends up saying is that what the state doesn't control is this institution called the Catholic Church. And that is precisely how not to do it in Harnack's world. The counterpower of the Catholic Church is not the power of the free conscience, with all that that implies about the dignity of the individual. Nonetheless, Catholicism does at least have a principle of resistance to complete totalitarianism, as we would call it. And in that respect, it's preferable to Eastern Orthodoxy. But it's still making a category mistake. What about Eastern Orthodoxy? Harnack actually knew more about Eastern Orthodoxy than probably any German scholar of his generation. He actually learned Russian in order to read monographs on some of the early Christian writers he'd included in his History of Dogma, the only reputable scholarly work at that time on the great Maximus the Confessor, the 8th century Byzantine theologian, was by a Russian scholar called Epifanovich, and Harnack dutifully learned Russian and read it, and visited Russia. In Russia, he was impressed by what he saw of peasant piety. He had enough sympathy with Tolstoy to feel, as the Count did, that there was something very remarkable, very moving, and very evangelical in the broadest sense about many aspects of peasant life in Russia. But it didn't have very much to do with the Orthodox Church. Because Eastern Orthodoxy, says Harnack, is natural religion, by which he doesn't mean the religion that comes naturally to human beings so much as a religion of nature. Orthodoxy is about things that happen. It's about stuff. It's about material transformation. It's about light beaming from the transfigured faces of the saints. It's about kissing relics and smearing yourself with oil. And you can imagine what Harnack thought of all that. This is the religion of nature. And he says, if you took Jesus Christ out of Eastern Orthodoxy, you wouldn't notice the difference. I said that he knew more about Eastern Orthodoxy than almost anybody else in Western Europe at the time. That is a rather sad reflection of the general level of knowledge of Eastern Orthodoxy, but I digress. But it does help us to see why, in his doctrinal histories, Harnack is very sceptical and indeed hostile about a certain style of doctrinal speculation, particularly associated with the Greek world from, say, 300 to 800, in which there's much focus on how the natures of the divine and the human are brought together in the person of Christ or in the sacraments of the Church. For Harnack, because this is about natures, it's not about morality. What about Protestantism? Well, says Harnack, it is universally agreed that Protestantism is in a very bad state. It's theologically under-equipped, it's communally weak, it's politically compromised. Harnack did not approve of state churches. In spite of his Lutheran heritage, he was very, very deeply unconvinced about the possibility of any kind of political backing for any religious body. So the fact that in 1899-1900, the reality of the state church was the way in which most Germans would experience Protestant Christianity was for Harnack a grievous embarrassment. And yet, he says, in spite of all that, it is the Protestant faith that has allowed millions of Germans, and he as it were, underlines Germans, millions of Germans, to have access to spiritual religion. That is to say, a religion that is free from ritual and dogma and hierarchy. It may be, in a rather compromised and unhelpful way, allied to the forms of a state church. Nonetheless, it is spiritual in a sense which Catholicism and Orthodoxy cannot be. So it's worth investing in. And in the 16th and last lecture, he does touch very briefly on the question of the German genius. Is Protestantism a particularly German creation? Well, he doesn't want to commit himself on that. There was, after all, a man called John Calvin. But how interesting that Calvin has never made any impact on the German soul, so he claims. Calvinism has only taken root among the English, the Scots, and the Dutch. And no self-respecting German, we are to understand, could really take it seriously in the light of that. Luther is a supreme example of the German genius. He is quintessentially a German, a fluent, persuasive, rhetorically enthusiastic and confident German who uses the language in a new way, who reshapes the imagination of a whole people. And, says Harnack in another gratuitous sideswipe at neighbours to the east, no Slav has ever done anything like that. So his ideal church, it seems, is the local gathering of morally serious individuals, not backed by legislation, minimally sacramental. There's almost nothing in this book about the life of the sacraments. Minimally institutional. There may be pastors, but there are certainly not bishops. A community in which love is cultivated, individual charity is encouraged, and moral perspective is deepened on both your personal and your public duties. The enormous popularity of Harnack's lectures, not only before but after the war, shows what a chord he struck in the German religious imagination, and not only the German. But the problems of his position are not too difficult to tease out. Perhaps we can put it most simply by saying that there's no sense in Harnack of conflicting identities. There may be in your spiritual self, your spiritual will, an awareness of the tension between different sorts of imperatives. But essentially, your identity is that of the citizen of the benign patriarchal state, to which you owe loyalty, in whose name you make oaths and may serve in the army. That there should be an identity as, let's say, a member of the community of the baptized, an identity which might set you apart in some way from the state, that's not there. And there's not even very much sense in Harnack of tension between, let's say, the obligations, the identities, the loyalties that go with family life and the state. In good patriarchal tradition, this is a state where the life of the family and the organic community is always in harmony with the life of the wider political unit. Or to put it in other terms, terms which Hegel would well have understood, there is no Creon and Antigone problem on the horizon here. So the freedom of conscience, which is so important for Harnack, remains something which never legitimizes resistance at the external level. It will legitimate mental reservation, semi-detachment, private scepticism, but not a pushing back against the state. Because if what we are working for is a Volk von Brüdern, a people of brothers, then you cannot pull away from the common task with the costs and the compromises that entails. Harnack would have been rather surprised to be told this, but there are aspects of his thought which are quite remarkably in tune with 17th century Anglicanism, with Lancelot Andrews preaching, as he did on Whitsunday in, I think, 1609, about the evils of Catholicism in terms of the evils of a worldly, political, violence-employing semi-state. That's what's wrong with Catholicism in Andrews's eyes. They chime with the views of later 17th and 18th century Anglicans when they try to define the much misunderstood phrase passive obedience. We owe the state passive obedience, meaning not that we necessarily do what the state orders, but that if we decide not to cooperate with the state, we must accept without protest what the state then does to us. Passive obedience. You recognize the right of the state to punish you, even if you assert your own right not actively to cooperate. Passive obedience. But Harnack's misfortune is to be speaking at the beginning of a century in which the ethical standing of the state is about to become more urgent and controversial than ever. Can political authority, existing political authority, actually be criticized or resisted in loyalty to civil society? Can our actual loyalty to civil society, with all that means, the specific moral communities to which we belong, can that provide a ground for actively resisting a state which is indeed asserting a Staatsomnipotenz, the right of the state in every sphere of life? One of the older Harnack's pupils was a young man called Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who found his own answer to that question in a way very, very much at odds with what Harnack had assumed. But Bonhoeffer would, I think, have said, if pressed, that was precisely what he was seeking to define: a loyalty to civil society that was not immediately and exhaustively coterminous with loyalty to the existing political settlement. Bonhoeffer was one of Harnack's favourite students, and Harnack was deeply dismayed when Bonhoeffer began to drift away under the malign influence of people like Karl Barth. But Bonhoeffer, who of course outlived Harnack, saw what Harnack was perhaps beginning to see at the end of his life, but never had the opportunity to confront fully. And that is the hypertrophism of the state, which appears in the Third Reich. Is the church there not only to cultivate inner dispositions, but to ground or educate civil society in the possibilities of resistance through its own social practice? Again, a question which Harnack consistently wants to avoid or indeed disallow. You could say that he doesn't see the moral tensions in political life as tensions about different kinds of belonging, or, as I said earlier, different kinds of identity. And yet that is one of the ways in which, very typically, the political stroke ethical problems of the 20th century actually work themselves out. And they are issues still with us. If you think of the continuing and very complex discussion about what it is, let's say, for a Muslim to understand diverse kinds of belonging within a single citizenship. I've mentioned once or twice the reaction of Karl Barth to Harnack. Barth, possibly the greatest Protestant theologian of the 20th century, if not ever, Barth had begun his ministry very much in Harnack's shadow and in Harnack's debt, like almost every other educated theologian in Germany. but it's Barthes himself who describes the experience of seeing Harnack's name in the list of subscribers to the Manifesto of the Intellectuals. A moment at which, Barthes says, his entire intellectual and spiritual world dissolved. Barthes believed that the events of 1914 were catastrophic, that the role of the Kaiser and the German government was malign, that there was need for public debate and public criticism, not the organic and patriarchal solidarity to which Harnack appealed. And Barthes began to rethink the foundations of his theology systematically, with results in the shape of millions of eloquent and exhilarating words familiar to possibly some in the room as the church dogmatics. Bonhoeffer represents a somewhat more subtle, more exploratory reaction to Harnack, and yet the same issues are there. By the end of the 1920s, the political climate in Germany was moving inexorably in a direction which Harnack, in fact, found as uncongenial, as did Barthes and Bonhoeffer. The difference was simply that Barthes and Bonhoeffer believed they had to look elsewhere for resources to meet this new and toxic Germany which was coming into being. It's not that well known that Harnack was one of those who drafted the constitution of the Weimar Republic. He attempted, in the post-war period, to do rather more than his lectures actually licensed him to do, that is, to move more actively into the public and political sphere and attempt to shape something like a pluralist and democratic society. He battled against the rising tide of anti-Semitism in Germany, to his eternal credit. And yet, when he died in 1930, it's hard not to think that he must have looked at his political life's work as profoundly under threat at that moment. But to understand something of what was going on in that heightened, overheated intellectual and spiritual environment of late summer 1914, to understand some of the confusions and the lacunae in public discourse, public thinking, it helps, I believe, to look back at the achievement of this extraordinary and, in the light of later events, tragic figure, who believed in total sincerity that it was indeed possible to define Christianity once and for all in a way that restricted it to the transformation of individuals, took it out of the risky public arena of conflict, debate, and policy formation, and preserved it safe for those whom Hegel would have called beautiful souls. Harnack is a giant among European intellectuals. That he is a flawed giant is perhaps to say no more than we would have to say about most intellectual giants in European history. But if we want to see something of the moral force, the moral perspective, which animated those who wanted, in the late summer of 1914, to defend the morality of Germany's response, Harnack is no bad place to start. The lectures on the essence of Christianity remain wonderful reading. They are vivid, often personal, pictorially clear, written in or delivered in a wonderfully elegant conversational German, which is a delight to read and is not by some of the English translations. They reflect a man who believed with all his heart that it was right for a theologian to be a public intellectual, but that the way in which a theologian was most appropriately a public intellectual was by the theologian carefully demarcating what the public and the private were about. and privileging the private. It's not an ignoble task or vision. That it didn't exactly work in the light of the 20th century, not least the 20th century in Germany, is not entirely Harnack's fault. But he leaves us with some profoundly interesting questions, not only about 100 years ago, but about Britain and Europe today. Thank you.
Rowan, you've achieved with your customary elegance and lucidity a work of some intellectual archaeology here this evening. You've recaptured for us the forgotten importance of von Harnack and what he represents in the history of the German mind and the history of the European thought. And this idea of the benign, the specifically German notion, you know, the benign patriarchal political order, so often confused with later developments and regarded as a source of, you know, reverence for authority in itself, Ordnung, etc. It may well also reflect the political circumstances of Germany, Kleinstaaterei, the Holy Roman Empire, the way in which political order would be decentralized is the wrong term because it was never centralized to begin with, but you know, somehow autonomous and organic in a way that the modern state, in its preeminent exemplar, the French Revolutionary Order, could not be seen as being. So this may take us to a particular area of the difference between Germany and the time that you're talking about, and indeed the French political tradition, the wider political tradition.
Absolutely, because if the essence of the modern French political tradition has been a kind of rationalism, which assumes that it is always possible to work out from first principles how representation should work in society and decisions should be made, go back to Rousseau and what he has to say about representation, then the characteristically German approach as represented by Harnack is to say, well, no, in the light of sort of late romantic Herderian strand in Germany, we are given certain things. We don't enter onto an empty stage. We don't start with a blank page. We belong already, je immer, always already, belonging to a political and social world. And how to criticize that or make it better? Well, we can have no general programs for that. We have to do it from within. It's almost as if, and it's an analogy that struck me thinking about Harnack in preparation for this, as if Harnack would like to see the entire German Empire as a large version of Goethe's Weimar.
Yes. I mean, it's the world of the elector and the prince bishop. Anyway, that's enough of me. I think, Rowan, that you've done the Legatum Institute a very great honour, not just in coming here this evening, but also in having devoted so much time and thought to the preparation of this really marvellous lecture, which has some of your most wonderful features about it, originality, the flair for the happy phrase, and the ability to come to a conclusion that also is an invitation to continued thought and continued reflection. Those who are called to the Christian ministry at any stage in the past 1800 years or so, rather depends when one thinks the Christian church actually started, of course, always have to encounter particular challenges and contradictions, skepticism, and rival forms of authoritarianism. But I think I speak on behalf of many, really, in this room and beyond, when I say that the Church of England was extremely fortunate in having had as its spiritual guide, if that's not too pompous a phrase to describe an Archbishop of Canterbury, a primate, as we must call him, a figure of Rowan Williams's intellect, who was able to take scepticism on board and to turn it into rational clarity and the communication of truth in a way that engages all minds in our country, whether Christian, agnostic, atheistic, or indeed Buddhistic. We did have the Dalai Lama here last year. Thank you very much indeed.